Good morning, everyone. My name's Dave, and welcome to the special one-hour edition of Insights for Health. This pandemic has been a tremendous hour of trial and division, both locally and around the world. So our topic today is COVID-19 update. This show is not about anti-vaccine or pro-vaccine. This show will offer you information so you can formulate an informed conclusion. To do this, I invited three guests, each one with a different perspective. A provincial public health representative who unfortunately was unable to coordinate with the recording schedule, a PhD epidemiologist to offer a global bird's eye view of the pandemic, and a frontline family physician who deals directly with COVID-19 patients, so that each one could answer fundamental questions that many of us are asking, to provide us with relevant information so that we can make an informed decision going forward. So welcome to the show. And we hope that you benefit from the content. Our guest today is Dr. Ira Bernstein. Dr. Bernstein is a frontline family physician in his 30th year of practice in North York. He is a graduate of the University of Toronto, where he also lectures. He is also an active staff in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Humber River Hospital. Dr. Bernstein is the medical advisor for Metabolic Balance Canada, a food-based, customized program conducted in 35 countries. He is also a co-founder of the Canadian COVID Care Alliance. Good morning, Dr. Bernstein, and welcome to Insights for Health.
Good morning, Dave. It's good to be with you.
So there's a lot of division within this pandemic. Families are being divided, friends are being divided, co-workers, even you and your colleagues in some cases are being divided.
Yes, we are certainly in difficult times. There's divisions based on concerns about treatments, vaccine mandates, lockdowns. You know, it goes on and on. So much information, misinformation. I think, you know, the public is confused. It's very difficult to know really what to believe during this pandemic because your public is being fed certain information through the media. And I have to say, not all of it is completely true, especially with regards to treatment, which we'll talk about today. So we're going to try and dispel some of that, what I call misinformation, and perhaps clear the air.
You being a frontline physician, you see the cases right up close and personal.
Sure. You know, I'm a family physician. I have an active practice in Toronto. And, you know, I've had certainly my fair share of COVID patients over the past year and a half. Interestingly, over the first wave or so, I saw very few cases. I just had one family who had contracted the virus, and then for 7 months, not a single case until the fall of 2020. So basically about a year ago is when I started seeing more patients contracting the virus. So it's very interesting how things went over time.
What is the difference between SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19?
SARS-CoV-2 is the name of the virus of this particular coronavirus. Now, coronaviruses have been around forever. They represent a type of common cold. People who are contracting colds, there's coronavirus, rhinovirus, they represent, you know, a common type of respiratory infection. This particular coronavirus, however, has different properties in that this one is newer and has the potential to create fairly severe illness of respiratory issues and inflammatory issues, and has the potential to cause more illness and hospitalization and potentially death, and has spread around the world fairly quickly since 2020. Now, COVID-19 happens to be the disease caused by this particular virus. So when someone is sick with SARS-CoV-2, we call that COVID-19. So that's going to be the constellation of symptoms, whether it's respiratory symptoms or whether they develop the cytokine storm and have a shortness of breath and clotting issues and they're hospitalized and all of these different complications and features of the disease, that is COVID-19.
Can you give us an overview? Who is at the highest risk and the lowest risk? Can you take us through that dynamic?
Absolutely. By far, age is the biggest risk factor. So if you're over the age of 60, and certainly with each decade going up, the risk of severe illness and death certainly increases. So most of the deaths have been in the elderly population, but also in those with underlying comorbidities, as we say. So obesity is a very big risk factor. Hypertension, diabetes, underlying respiratory disease such as COPD, asthma, sickle cell disease, if you have cancer, if you have underlying health issues, that will certainly increase the risk of developing COVID-19, the disease. People who are least at risk are those who are young. So the youth, children, teens, the risk of severe illness is exceptionally, exceptionally low. Effectively, although there are always exceptions to the rule, but statistically speaking, the fatality rate for young people is close to zero. So you have to keep that in mind. There are other respiratory infections that may also cause severe illness, including in young children. Young children, when influenza is around, end up being hospitalized with that. So you have to keep in mind that, you know, there is always the potential for anyone of any age to get sick. But when you look at statistics and what the epidemiology shows about the infection fatality rate, the rate is, in general, fairly low overall, but definitely increases as you get older and much, 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 much lower the younger you are.
Do you know any statistics regarding mortality rate in relation to COVID-19 compared to an annual influenza?
You know, I think it's overall is probably a little bit higher than influenza. Perhaps for the older population, it is higher than influenza. But for the younger people, it's probably the same or less. Most young people get a very mild illness. The children, they get a cold-like symptoms. You know, it's interesting with influenza, seen in my own practice, where young people can get a significant influenza illness that has greater respiratory symptoms. But for COVID-19, for the most part, it's pretty low. Now, I think the mortality rate may have been declining over time, whether that has to do with better diagnosis and better treatments. So we don't have the same number of deaths at the present time that we were having in the first waves of the pandemic, which really hit the nursing homes. Long-term care were hit quite hard. The infection would spread through the long-term care, and you'd have these outbreaks, and there's quite a bit of mortality within the nursing home. So basically the most vulnerable, based on the basis of age and underlying health issues, and certainly nutritional status, which we'll talk about after, they were most at risk. And that's where we saw many of the deaths in the early months of the pandemic. We don't have these massive numbers of deaths in the current situation, which is fortunate.
So in the beginning, there was what you doctors call a standard of care. Can you first tell us what that is and what is it now? Has it changed at all from the beginning?
The standard of care has been, for the most part, very, I'd say, non-traditional. It is supportive only. I'd call it therapeutic nihilism, meaning when someone is diagnosed with the infection, they say they have symptoms, they go to a testing center, and they're told the next day or so that their PCR is positive. The patient is then told to go home, to isolate, wash your hands, take some Tylenol, drink fluids, and you're to quarantine for 2 weeks as well as your household contacts. And then you're told, well, if you're blue in the lips, if you can't breathe, then come back to the hospital. That has been the standard of care, where there is no active treatment during the viral replication phase. That really hasn't changed at all as far as the standards are concerned, based on what our health authorities are recommending. Nothing has changed. So all of the regulators, Health Canada, the science tables, they basically say there are no early treatments. So go home and do nothing until you can't breathe. That is unfortunate, because that's when people will end up progressing to full COVID-19 disease and end up in hospital. And some of those will end up on ventilators, and some of those will die. You know, it's very concerning to me as a physician who understands the science and potential medications that can be used to treat the disease early, that for the most part, these are being suppressed.
And that's where the controversy is. You as doctors and we the public, the old adage, what do you do when doctors disagree? Here's the general public. We're hearing a narrative from a health minister, both federally, provincially, saying one thing. And then we're hearing controversy where others are speaking up and saying, wait a minute, there's some boulders in the road here. There's some potholes in the road. So then it's creating this question of why, as a frontline person, you're doing certain things and getting excellent results versus what the government narrative is. Why is there this divide, Doctor?
you know, these are questions that I've been asking for the past year and a half. Nothing really has made sense. As far as I'm concerned, none of these controversies should exist. Basically, we have knowledge of studies, therapeutics, that are available that have been tested and used around the world. And for some reason, many of these are being suppressed. You know, to start off with, there is the nutritional aspect that I think is very important that I think we should talk about first for supporting your immune system. When the pandemic hit, one of the first things that I did was help educate my patients on how to support their immune system with proper nutrition. And I did this based on a consensus with a group that I work with, the Canadian Integrative Medicine Association. And we met weekly, you know, early on in the pandemic to discuss nutrition and therapeutics. So we came to an agreement based on appropriate nutrients such as vitamin D, vitamin C, zinc, selenium, based on best practices and the current science. Specifically with respect to vitamin D, it's quite interesting because there has been data for decades regarding the role of vitamin D. It's not just for your bones. It acts as a hormone, and it's involved in so many cellular processes. And what we've learned over time, specifically related to COVID-19, the disease, is that individuals who are deficient in vitamin D are much more likely to end up hospitalized and potentially in an intensive care unit and on a ventilator. So something like having the right amount of vitamin D on board in advance to help reduce the risk of developing that cytokine storm is something that is so easy to do, and that should be recommended to all Canadians. So what we were doing was recommending at least a minimum 2,000 international units of vitamin D daily for adults. Vitamin D is the sunshine vitamin. Canadians don't get enough of that sunshine. Our summers are very short. And of course, last year, with all the lockdowns, we were told to stay inside, so no one's going outside getting the appropriate exercise and the sunlight, and so we're all deficient in vitamin D. Pretty much, unless you're supplementing with vitamin D, your blood level will likely not be at optimal level, being a level of 75 or higher. So you really need to supplement in order to get it there. You're not going to get it from the diet alone.
And that would be such a simple fix, but yet we've never heard that as being part of the toolbox. The narrative that we've heard is put on a mask, social distance, your hand washing. Why wouldn't they, and I know, Doc, you can't answer this because you weren't part of the decision-making team that came up with this, but why not add vitamin D to that list of tools as just good preventative? Maybe that's just the question to the audience that I can ask. Why haven't we heard anything about this? Unless you come into a health food store and then they're telling you about it, or people have done their own research. But to the masses, why wasn't that ever said?
I've been asking the same question for the past year and a half. Why have our government agencies not been making this recommendation? In fact, our federal minister of health was asked that, I think around April of this year, by Derek Sloan, during question period, remote question period. And he asked specifically, why aren't Canadians being advised to take vitamin D based on all the available research out there? And her reply was something to the extent of, I don't believe in fake news. So it's very concerning for myself as a physician when our trusted authorities are making these claims that vitamin D is fake news. And nothing could be further than the truth. And that is misinformation, and that is doing a disservice to Canadians. From my perspective, if we had standing orders for vitamin D, say 2,000 international units for vitamin D as a standing order in all long-term care facilities where residents are not getting any sunshine, and likely the food that they're eating there is not likely optimal in terms of vitamin D levels, I would like to see where this is an automatic order for every resident, because it's so safe. There's absolutely no risk of toxicity. At 2,000 units a day, the therapeutic range is actually very, very high. So I have no concerns about making a blanket statement of 2,000 units a day. Now, for someone who hasn't been taking any vitamin D, I would say, you know, start off with 4,000 or 5,000 units a day, because it takes a while to build up the proper levels. So you don't want to wait until you get sick before you start nutritionally supplementing. You want to start this in advance. And this is, like I said, what I've been preparing my patients to have the right nutrients.
Let's take a quick commercial break. You have a long list of other nutrients that are excellent for prevention and that you also use in treatment. Can we pick up there?
We shall.
Welcome back to Insights for Health, this special one-hour edition on COVID-19 insights. So our guest today is Dr. Ira Bernstein, a frontline family physician. Before the break, we began to discuss some of the nutrients and the importance of vitamin D, but you have a continuing list of supplements and treatments.
Some of the other nutrients that we're recommending to help support your immune system include vitamin C. So typically we'd recommend between 1,000 and 3,000 milligrams a day. And the benefits of vitamin C include modulating cellular defense and repair mechanisms. It helps modulate viral-induced pathological cellular processes. There's evidence for vitamin D in reducing mortality in sepsis, which is severe infection. Other nutrients include zinc. Zinc is antiviral. So I would typically be recommending 20 milligrams minimum for my patients. If you haven't been taking, 30 to 60 milligrams a day might be something more reasonable to bump up. And what does zinc do? Zinc suppresses viral attachment and replication. It helps prevent infection. It reduces severity and duration of infection. It reduces the risk of lower respiratory infections, and the level of evidence is actually quite strong. Zinc has potent inhibitory properties. Zinc has to get into the cell in order to help prevent, reduce viral replication. So in order to get into the cell, it requires what we call a zinc ionophore. So an example of a zinc ionophore is another supplement called quercetin. So if someone is sick, I would recommend at least 500 milligrams once or twice daily, and that will help transport zinc into the cell. It helps inhibit the viral replication as well as reduction of symptoms. Vitamin A is very important, between 10,000 and 25,000 international units a day. This is known as an anti-inflammatory vitamin. It has a critical role in enhancing immune function. It reduces symptom duration, can help reduce mortality, help reduce the incidence of viral illness, and it has a strong level of evidence. Other nutrients can include elderberry, 500 milligrams. This helps reduce and improve symptoms. When I get a flu or cold-like illness in the past, although fortunately it doesn't happen too often, and that contains a combination of vitamin C, zinc, elderberry, and echinacea, all in one. Mix this powder with some water and you take for up to 14 days. You only take it when you feel something coming on. You don't take it, that product, when you're well. And it actually, I find it's quite helpful in speeding up resolution. Other supportive nutrients include melatonin. Melatonin traditionally used to help sleep, but it's not just a sleep aid. Melatonin has anti-inflammatory properties. So between 5 and 20 milligrams a day may be helpful during actually the acute COVID illness. Curcumin or turmeric has anti-inflammatory properties, and now there's evidence to support the role of that in COVID-19. Selenium as a micronutrient, a mineral, 100 micrograms a day. Magnesium, start at 50 to 100 milligrams a day and increase to bowel tolerance. Magnesium is so important in numerous cellular processes. And I can tell you, clinically, many, many patients suffer from magnesium deficiency. This is all so common. Some of the manifestations of magnesium deficiency include constipation, palpitations, leg cramps. So frequently patients present with these symptoms all the time, and doctors will prescribe other drugs to counteract those symptoms, when in fact they should just be supplementing with magnesium. Or supplements include probiotics, which are friendly bacteria. Your gut health is very strongly linked with your immune system. Garlic and honey, they are associated with immune system and prevention and severity of infection with viruses that cause colds, and honey has antioxidant and antimicrobial properties. So these are the list of common nutrients that will help support your immune system, reduce the risk of severe illness, and that is what I recommend to my patients. The goal is, if you contract the virus, you want to do everything you can so that your immune system will fight off the virus without developing the complications being that cytokine storm. That is where people get into trouble, typically in the second week. So it's not the virus that is killing people. It is your own dysfunctional immune system triggered by the virus, causing a cascade of massive inflammation. A lot of this is related to deficiencies of nutrients and your underlying health and risk factors. So you want to do what you can to minimize the risk of developing that cytokine storm where patients get very sick. And like I said, vitamin D alone, low vitamin D is significantly correlated with an increased risk of hospitalization.
So if the immune system is optimized, we will have the best chance. The inhibition of the replication. So we get the virus if we can fight it off right away versus if it's allowed to replicate.
Absolutely. Treat early reduces risk of complications. And that's the whole point of countering the so-called standard of care of no treatment. Like I said, it doesn't make sense. There is no other medical condition where we have this therapeutic nihilism. For example, if someone is diagnosed with diabetes and their sugar is going up, we don't wait till the sugar goes over 30 and they end up in the hospital with diabetic ketoacidosis before we start treating the patient with insulin or other therapeutics. No, you make the diagnosis and you start it early. On the same token, think of this analogy. You know, you're doing some cooking and you have a little stove fire. You put out the fire early instead of leaving everything burning and then the whole house burns down. That's what potentially happens in COVID-19, where you let the flames continue to grow unopposed when you could have taken action to help treat it early.
And this is what we discussed in the first segment, was this standard of care. Go home, drink fluids, take a Tylenol, and if you run into complications, then come back. Early treatment, it's in that first 1 to 7 days, correct?
Absolutely, yeah. There are different treatments. There's a whole variety of what we'd say repurposed medications that can be used to treat COVID-19. Medications that can be used in the initial viral replication phase, and there are others that can be used during the inflammatory phase. And none of these have been specifically indicated for COVID-19. We call this off-label use. And physicians prescribe medications off-label all the time. I think at least 20% of prescriptions that we write are considered off-label. You know, that simply means that we are writing a prescription for a patient with informed consent to treat a condition for a reason that is not under the original approval for that product. So it doesn't mean you can't use it. It just means it doesn't have the official indication by the authorities. And it doesn't mean it's unsafe. So there are a number of medications, and you may have heard early in the pandemic, a lot of controversy surrounding the medication hydroxychloroquine. Hydroxychloroquine has been around for decades, and a lot of data suggesting that use of it early in treatment as a zinc ionophore helps patients recover. There are physicians who have been treating thousands of patients with hydroxychloroquine along with azithromycin, an antibiotic plus zinc, in protocols, and barely a single patient has been hospitalized. And this is amongst thousands. Doctors Farid and Tyson in the United States, I believe in California, they too have treated thousands of patients quite successfully with very few patients being hospitalized. Problem with hydroxychloroquine is it obtained a lot of bad press last year. You heard about Donald Trump promoting it. There was a fraudulent study published in The Lancet, a very reputable journal. Big study that said hydroxychloroquine is harmful. It's killing people. There was only one problem. The data was completely made up, 100%. It did not exist. It was ultimately retracted 2 weeks later, but the damage was done. And this is something that's very concerning. However, physicians who are on the front lines and treating COVID-19 and have their clinical experience using these products know that it still works when you use it early. So that's one of the medications that's still in the toolbox that you can use. Subsequent to hydroxychloroquine, the data started coming out regarding ivermectin. Ivermectin originally developed some 40 years ago as an antiparasitic agent. The developers, the inventors of ivermectin, won the Nobel Prize in 2015. It's on the list of essential medicines with the World Health Organization. It has been used in approximately 4 billion patients around the world. It has been discovered that it has some antiviral and anti-inflammatory properties. So over the past year and a half, there have been numerous clinical trials around the world that show benefit in prevention and treatment of COVID-19. And yet, interestingly, more recently, there has been huge vilification of ivermectin in mainstream media, by the regulators, by the FDA, CDC, World Health Organization, Health Canada, for some reason all coming down saying that there's no evidence of benefit. It's very concerning to see what is going on here, where people, organizations, supposedly trusted agencies, are interpreting the data despite there being excellent meta-analyses, which is basically studies pooled with their data involving thousands of patients showing benefit. And yet these organizations are stating there's no benefit. What's interesting, however, that I just learned about the NIH, the National Institute of Health, if you do a search for Table 2E, COVID-19 antiviral treatments, you will see a table that actually now lists ivermectin as a therapeutic. It's listed on the same table as remdesivir, which has problems in itself, kidney and liver issues, but that's a whole other story. But I was not aware that the NIH was actually listing ivermectin on their website as an agent that has antiviral properties that's either approved or under investigation, along with some other agents. So that was reassuring that not all agencies say, don't use it.
So we've talked about supplementation, using our immune system as a preventative to not acquire, or if we do, we can fight it off and possibly not even know we have fought it off. If we acquire the virus, there are treatments that you as a frontline physician can use and have these tools at your disposal. If these are proven effective, why aren't they endorsed? Why are they being silenced? And we could benefit from it. I'm confused.
I'm confused as well. I mean, none of this makes sense, particularly since there are countries around the world that have endorsed these agents in their fight against COVID-19. And countries that are doing this are showing tremendous results. States in India, for example, Uttar Pradesh, which had a very large outbreak in all of India, they instituted broad-based ivermectin plus vitamin D and zinc to their population, to those who are infected and their family contacts. And they brought the pandemic completely under control. So it really doesn't make sense why our countries are saying, hey, not only should you not use it, but now certain provinces in Canada, doctors are being told you can't use it. They're now being told by their regulators, so the colleges of physicians that regulate doctors, have been told in certain provinces, Alberta and British Columbia, thou shalt not prescribe it, pharmacy shall not dispense it. In my lifetime, I've never encountered anything like this before, where the regulators are interfering with that doctor-patient relationship, and where there is the potential for benefit and little risk of harm from using these medications, these policies are putting Canadians at risk. And that, to me, is very concerning, especially when there is a plethora of evidence. You know, these agencies are claiming the studies are poorly done, they're at high risk of bias. It's really quite incredible that this has never been seen before in any other condition. When is this going to end? When is this going to end? When is the harm to Canadians going to end? When are people going to start waking up and realizing what's going on here? That physicians are being interfered with, censored, investigated, restrictions on their licenses put in place, all because they're trying to help patients. None of these physicians have a conflict of interest. And I can tell you, any physician who has been treating patients knows the results that they get. I mean, there is something to be said for clinical experience. I've been treating patients since last November. It's almost 1 year since I treated my first patient with repurposed medications, all with informed consent. And I can tell you that when you help a patient recover at home without ending up in hospital, they are ever so grateful. They are so thankful for the help that you've done. Ask the patients. Ask any patient who's been treated for COVID-19. And the other thing to keep in mind, when you treat COVID-19, you don't end up with long COVID. Long COVID is the result of untreated COVID.
We'll continue with Dr. Bernstein right after the break.